Okay, good afternoon. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:44 p.m. on Wednesday, May 7th, 2025. And present today, we have Representative Allard, Representative Hannon, Representative Bynum, Representative Co-Chair Shragi, Representative Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Stapp, myself, Co-Chair Foster. And just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. We've got three bills this afternoon. The first one is we'll pick up where we left off this morning on House Bill 123. That's taxation of vehicle rentals. We'll take up questions and then the amendments. And if it's the will of the committee, we'll move the bill. The next bill that we've got after that is House Bill 78. That's the PERS bill. We do have seven amendments on that bill. And if it's the will of the committee, we'll also move that bill. And then we'll also hear Senate Bill 80, and that's various boards extension bill. So with that, going back to House Bill 123, did we have any questions? Representative McCabe, did you want to come up in case folks had any questions to you? Or if you've got questions on the fiscal note, we can go there too. Were there any more questions? Okay, I don't see any questions. So with that, we do have an amendment before us. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair Foster. I move Amendment 1.
Okay, and I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. Amendment number 1, what it does is it removes the section of the effective date from immediately to July 1, 2025. The reason for the amendment is to align the effective date with a fiscal year and the beginning of a tax quarter. If this is too soon, we do have an alternative for a substitute on this, but this is where we are today.
Great. Thank you. Representative McCabe, do you have any thoughts on whether this is a friendly or otherwise amendment?
Thanks, Co-Chair Foster. I appreciate that. No, I think this is a great amendment. It allows the department a little bit more time, and it's not going to materially affect the bill one way or the other, except give them some more time and give everybody time to adjust, which I think is fabulous.
Great. Do we have any further questions on Amendment number 1? Representative Galvin?
Yes, I would ask, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, representative, the maker of the amendment. Have we checked in with the department to know that this date is sufficient?
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. When our staff ran through on this, it didn't seem that there would be any issues with this, and it also allows the industry that amount of time, especially the smaller companies, to be able to meet the requirements of the new law.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I guess my question, and I'm thinking out loud as I'm reading that, is probably for the sponsor, but I guess when I was reading the bill, the original bill having an immediate effective date, I guess my thought was that's when revenue can set things up, but they weren't going to start collecting that day. Now, this puts it out 6 weeks, and I don't know if that makes – to start collecting on July 1st, we probably need to have it set up prior to that, and whether this forestalls us collecting revenue for a six-week or longer period because they can't even start the setup for the collection until July 1. And my concern would be we have a fiscal note prepared showing – a year of revenue, and if we're going to do this, I'd like us to have the full fiscal year. So I don't know, with the immediate effective date in there, whether the sponsor had anticipated they were collecting revenue immediately or they were setting up and that the revenue collection would take a few weeks' delay.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, and through the co-chair, I didn't really consider it either way. I didn't really consider the loss of 6 weeks' worth of revenue. It's probably a wash with giving the department time to set everything up and get going. I have really no opinion one way or the other. I think it's good for the Department of Revenue, probably not so good for our revenue by losing 6 weeks. I get that.
I'd just like to note that we also have with us Representative Jimmy and Representative Johnson. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Ultimately, this provision was put in not to protect the Department of Revenue, but to protect the people that are going to have to collect these taxes because the law goes into effect immediately changing these rates, and then those people in industry are going to have to go through the process of collecting. So I don't believe that, I believe through regulation they'll have they'll have to submit on their quarterly or whatever is established under regulation. They're not remitting immediately, but they'll end up having to collect immediately. So this gives those businesses enough time to make the adjustments in their software for how they, when they do their charges, and it's actually putting the rate in and charging the customer. This gives those businesses a 6-week window to be able to make those adjustments before this goes into effect.
We do have Dustin Henselman with the Excise Audit Group Manager, Department of Revenue in Anchorage. Mr. Henselman, I don't know if you have anything that you could add, but if you do, if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, Dustin Heinzelman, Excess Audit Group Manager for the Department of Revenue Tax Division. I do not have anything to add. I don't think the department has a position on whether or not it's immediate or if it is July 1st.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hannon and Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And his name has escaped me already. From the Department of Revenue, what's your anticipated time frame to be able to stand up, notify taxpayers, and begin collecting the revenue from this tax?
Mr. Henselman?
For the record, Dustin Heinzelman, Excise Audit Group Manager, Tax Division, through the chair. We are prepared to implement it immediately. However, as was stated previously, an immediate effective date would have the taxpayers have to collect that immediately. And so in an effort of disseminating information, I think it would be, the information would be easier to get out if there was a delay in implementation. But again, the department is able to implement it immediately.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Galvin.
This is not a question for the previous speaker, so if that's okay, I would proceed. I just wanted to add that I understand the mindset that I'm now hearing from the maker of the amendment, because as one who has done Airbnb, had that as my business, I do appreciate that. When I learned about the additional taxes that I would be needing to pay, it was too late to pass that along, if you will, or change my rates in order to be able to meet those. So given that, I can understand that, especially if there have been some previous commitments made to clients at certain rates that just might be a little bit tricky and too much to put on a small business. So anyhow, given that, my small experience, I can appreciate why you have put this forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any wrap-up comments, Representative Bynum?
No, thank you, Co-Chair.
Okay, I'm going to remove my objection. Are there any further objections? Hearing none, Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 123, version the one that's before us, is adopted. And so with that, are there any further questions or comments before I entertain a motion? Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I just have one very brief comment, and that is I will be supporting this moving forward. That said, I do think that there may be amendments that would make sense down the road. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Representative Co-Chair Josephson, I would entertain a motion. I'm sorry. Shroggy.
Okay. I move House Bill 123, version 34-LS0551/I, out of committee as amended, just amended, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Josephson. Are there any objections? Hearing no objections. House Bill 123, which is version 34-LS0551/I, moves out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And if folks can be sure to sign the committee report. And thank you so very much, Representative McCabe.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks, Co-Chair Foster.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to jump right into the next bill here. As soon as I sign the committee report, we're done. And we have before us House Bill 78. That's the PERS bill. And we have heard this bill 9 times in committee. We've reviewed the actuarial and fiscal notes. 7 amendments were submitted. So I'd like to invite Representative Kopp and his staff, Ms. Julia O'Connor, please come to the table and put yourselves on the record. And if you could just give us a very brief recap of the bill, and then we'll go into amendments.
Thank you, committee. It's a privilege to be back. Just highlighting a brief recap. The basic structure of the bill is a shared risk hybrid option for a pension for public employees that are currently employed. In addition to the defined contribution that they have now, it gives employees a chance to stay in the defined contribution plan or elect into the defined benefit plan following a 180-day window. And then going forward, the default is the defined benefit plan. And that's the purpose of the bill is to improve greater stability in our workforce, make Alaska a more competitive employer, and strengthen the fabric of our public service infrastructure to make Alaska more attractive for business and families to relocate here. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Josephson, you have amendment number one.
I move amendment number one.
Okay, object for purpose of discussion. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. First, I'll describe in a summary statement what this amendment does, and then I'll tell you more about it. In summary, this amendment would allow new defined benefit employees under this tier created by this bill, House Bill 78, to opt into defined contribution for a period of 5 years, and then they would waive that opportunity. So when the defined contribution plan was passed in 2005, there was a provision to allow existing defined benefit employees to opt into the new defined contribution plan. That remains in law today. In House Bill 78, all new employees would be enrolled in the new defined benefit program. So that's where new employees start. Existing defined contribution employees would have an option to join the new tier with a process for converting their accounts. In the bill as written, the defined contribution plan would be closed to new members, but would retain those current members who choose to stay and to not convert to the new plan. Amendment number one adds a choice for the new defined benefit employees. They would have the ability to switch to the defined contribution plan at any point in their first 5 years of employment before they are vested. If you look at the text of the amendment, most of it is conforming language. The guts of the change in Amendment 1 is actually on page 2, lines 5 to 6. This is in the repealers section of the bill. The current bill repeals the sections that allowed pre-2006 defined benefit employees to convert to defined contribution plan. By passing this amendment, it leaves open that existing process for the new defined benefit employees if they were to choose to convert to the defined contribution plan. The other effect of this amendment would be to keep open the defined contribution plan for new members. So I know that's a lot of information, but the simple version is, while I believe it would be in the self-interest of most new state and local and school district employees to join the defined benefit as they must and stay there, there could be some circumstances where a person would want to move to a defined contribution plan. So, for example, this could be someone who truly wanted just to spend a couple of years in Alaska and had no intention to remain. And so this is I think Representative Kopp can tell you more about it, but this is designed to offer some freedom of movement while starting the new tier in the defined benefit position.
Great. Thank you very much. As we move forward with the amendments, just want to let folks know if there are questions for the actuarial company that we have for us. We do have David Kirshner online, consultant with Arthur J. Gallagher and Company. He is calling from Aiken, South Carolina, so it's about 6 o'clock there. We also have online Kathy Lee, Director of Division of Retirement and Benefits here in Juneau, and she's online. So folks have questions. Just want to first go to Representative Kopp and just get your thoughts on Amendment Number 1, and then I'll go to Representative Bynum. Representative Kopp.
Chair Foster, thank you. I believe the amendment is a good one. It preserves choice while still pointing Alaska's workforce toward a more secure, fiscally responsible defined benefit system. But if we look at our dearth of teachers in Alaska right now, many teachers are coming up into many school districts across the state just to be here for 2 years. They're just, you know, they're getting the Alaska experience. We're bringing them in every way we can. And there's no way they're going to be here for a long period of time. And I only mention teachers because they're in the news all the time. We're bringing them in from other countries. And this would help us be more competitive by having an option, especially early on. I appreciate that the default plan is still the defined benefit plan. That is the plan. But if you're somebody who sees that one of our many school districts is desperate for a state employee job, and you say, you know, I can come up there for 2 or 3 years and fill that position, but you realize the pension is not the ideal plan for you, you would have a defined contribution option. This has been brought to our attention by several large employers of school districts and other agencies where they feel like this option is good for those jobs that people are coming up to fill for 2 or 3 years. That's the whole point of the recruitment is come up, fill those in. But we're hoping that with the default being the defined benefit, we'll see what we believe is the 80% of people who will still opt into that and stay in that plan. But we think Alaska will be more broadly competitive for early workers in their career and also people coming up just to do a contract job position if we have this as an option. Appreciate Representative Josephson offering the amendment.
Great. Thank you. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I was going to say I actually like this amendment and appreciate it being brought forward. I was hoping to hear from the actuary on what they think that this potentially would do to long-term impact to the plan or the fund, and then also from the division on whether or not this might create any problems for them.
Okay. First, we'll go to Mr. David Kirshner. Mr. Kirshner, if you can put yourself on record and answer the question.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, I'm David Kirshner, actuary with Gallagher. The projections that we provided in our March 24th fiscal note letter and that we discussed at last week's House Finance Committee meeting assumed that all existing active members would elect to switch from the defined contribution retirement plan to the defined benefit plan, and that all future hires would enter the defined benefit plan. So if this, under this amendment, to the extent that some of the future hires decide to stay in or go into the defined contribution plan rather than the defined benefit plan, that would have a small impact on our, well, depends on how many of those elect to go into defined contribution. But to the extent that there are some new hires that elect defined contribution, that would decrease the projected cost amounts that we provided previously.
And before we go to the next question, just want to see while we've got Mr. Kirshner here on this question, does anybody have any questions regarding actuary? Seeing none, Representative Bynum, do you have any follow-up on that?
No, thank you.
Okay. Next, we'll go over to Ms. Kathy Lee. If you could put yourself on the record and address Representative Bynum's question.
Okay. This is Kathy Lee. I'm the Director of the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Regarding this amendment, we would have to check with our tax counsel to see if this election 5 years into being in the DB plan is allowable by the IRS. I know they allow different elections at the time of hire, but I am not positive whether or not they would allow a member to be in a DB plan and then elect to switch to a DC 5 years in. So that's something we'll have to look at.
Representative Bynum and then Stepp. Representative Bynum.
Thank you. I didn't have a follow-up for that, but I did have just a quick clarifying question. Is this only restricted to teachers, or is this going to be for all members entering into the plan?
Representative Kopp.
Yes, this amendment, as drafted, is applicable to the entire House Bill 78 plan, which would be for all employees. Thank you for the question.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Representative Stepp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Ms. Lee. sorry about the cough there. What if you did it the other way around? I'm sure it would be acceptable if you started in DC and then opted them into DB for the tax tracking type, through the chair.
Ms. Lee?
Through the chair, the problem is, as I understand it, giving what the IRS considers two bites at the apple. And that's why they generally restrict an election at the time of hire. I am not 100% sure if this is allowable or not, whichever way we flip it, because they just look at two different retirement plans, and when you are allowed to participate in it and when you are allowed to make a different choice.
Representative Stepp.
Thanks.
Okay, any further questions on amendment number one? Seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection. Do you maintain your objection, Representative Stepp?
Yeah, I'm going to object. So to me, so I don't, so you know, I have an amendment later in the packet that kind of addresses this. I think this amendment one actually does make the bill better than it is currently. So I'm going to remove my objection after I'm done speaking. I would just say from a risk standpoint, probably better if you're going to default new employees into something that they default into a DC plan as opposed to a DB plan. So with that, I'll withdraw my objection.
Okay, the objection has been withdrawn. Seeing no further objection, amendment number one to House Bill 78, version N, has been adopted. So with that, we're going to move over to the second amendment, and Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I move amendment two.
Okay, we'll object for purpose of discussion. Representative Hannon.
Okay, so this amendment makes changes to clarify the statutory responsibilities of the ARM Board and ensure that the proposed defined benefit retirement tier is managed with fiscal discipline. The amendment strengthens language around board duties, sets a minimum funded ratio policy, and provides flexibility in funded methods. You'll see on the amendment there are four provisions. The may to shall that you find the first on page 8 to line 10, and then on the bottom, page 37, line 28. In both places, that is changing a may to a shall, directing the ARM Board to increase member contributions. One is for the PERS. That's the first one on page 8. Page 37 is TERS. That the ARM Board, if those plans are likely to fall below 90% funding, then they shall implement instead of giving them latitude of may. The change on page 21 will add an explicit policy that they need to make sure they have, if the fund was to drop below 90%, that they must include a policy to address that before it reaches below 90%. The fourth element is deletes the provision that the ARM Board used for calculation, the level percent of pay amortization method. That's what is currently in statute. This would remove that and allow the ARM Board to use actuarially guided and decide whether a level percent of pay or a level dollar value should be used, because those change depend on the economic circumstances. But if we Currently in statute it is that they must use a level percent of pay. This takes that out and allows the ARM board to base the decision on which amortization method they used based on current actuarial device. So it could change periodically. Those are the four provisions in amendment number two, and I'd ask for your support.
Great, thank you. Representative Cobb, thoughts?
Yes, Chair Foster, and thank you for the amendment, Representative Hannon. So I believe this is a very sound amendment. It provides a very clear direction to the ARM board that we do want them to take action to use the 90% funding levers in the bill should the fund ever dip below 90%, that they will take action both with the member contributions and the post-retirement pension adjustments. To keep it, the actuaries have testified that's one of the things that make this bill so solid, is it does react dynamically to the market. And this language being more prescriptive takes away some of the political concern that maybe the ARM board won't do the right thing for the future liability of the plan. So I like that. The 90% funded ratio floor is already in the bill, but what this amendment does is it directs the ARM board to have written policies that support the statute, that their policies will reflect their commitment to a 90% or greater funding plan. And this was widely supported by the Alaska Municipal League, who were looking at some of the policies of the ARM board, and they said it'd be great if they had policies that would support the bill. So I think this is consistent with that. And then the level percent of pay versus a level dollar amortization way of addressing it, this has become an issue, Mr. Chair. We have found that a level percent of pay on your, if you look at the pension as a mortgage, you will pay larger interest and less principal up front, but eventually you'll get to your pay down date. A level dollar pay, you pay more principal and less interest up front. So the challenge of the ARM board is faced is it's in statute right now that they'll use this level percent of pay, which actually works out to about 10% longer and greater deficit before you finally do reach a zero balance in your unfunded liability. So we spoke with the director of the ARM board about this, and he said it would be great if this prescriptive language that locks us into basically a longer way of amortizing this be removed so that we could go back to a more aggressive level dollar pay. And based on the advice of the ARM board actuary and the state actuary. So we like the amendment, and we think it's consistent with the whole spirit of the bill for maximum doing away with unfunded liability and rigid adherence to a high level of funding.
Great, thank you. Questions, comments on amendment number two? Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I appreciate, Co-Chair, this amendment. I especially am supportive of clarity for the ARM board. I have one question, and it may not be relevant, but I think they meet quarterly, the ARM board does. So is the assumption that it would be at the nearest board meeting when it falls below 90%, or is it necessary to put a timeline in there is my question.
Representative Hannon.
Co-Chair Foster, I don't know if we have an ARM board official on there.
We do not.
I do not have knowledge, although in the back of my mind, my recollection is they meet quarterly, I don't think they set their policies for funding ratio. I think there's a time frame like annual that they set those, not that each policy every quarter could be up for change. But Ms. Kathy Lee may also know since she participates in all those ARM board meetings.
Ms. Lee?
Well, Representative Hannon is correct in that the board meets quarterly, but there is one meeting scheduled during the year in which they adopt the actuarial valuation, which indicates the funding levels of the plans. Aside from that, I know they do call special meetings occasionally when needed, but I do believe an answer directly from the ARM board is probably preferable than what I'm giving you.
Representative Galvin.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I think given that we know that there is a set time where that is typically looked at, then it would make sense that if it should fall within that year before that meeting, that that would be the time when that would be done. So I'm very comfortable with this. Thank you very much.
Further questions, comments on amendment number two? Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, I think for Representative Kopp or one of our state officials, do we have any idea how much more? So I think the ARM board toward Christmas or something, Thanksgiving, reports to OMB what the outlay should be every year. Do we have any sense what moving to level dollar might increase that number to?
Representative Kopp.
So Chair Josephson, this amendment doesn't do that. It doesn't move us to a level dollar. It simply allows the ARM board to apply the level dollar or the percent of pay as will most aggressively pay down our unfunded liability. One of the additional things I forgot to mention earlier is under percent of pay, there was an assumption that payroll would grow over time. So your percent of pay, you should be making larger and larger payments. But the state of Alaska actually has fewer employees today than we did in 2005. So that assumption went out the window. And that's why they may want to go to a level dollar as being a more true, aggressive way to pay down the liability. But we're not telling them which one to use here. We're moving the prescriptive language so they can have the flexibility to pursue the plan that most aggressively pays down the unfunded liability.
Okay.
Representative Josephson.
I know that we had, back when David Teal was our alleged finance director in the mid-teens, we had the level percent of pay, and I hopefully the ARM board will take into account our fiscal position to some degree.
They're very sensitive to our fiscal position. That's the point of this amendment. Thank you, Chair Josephson. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Further questions on amendment number two, Representative Stapp?
Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, the Chair, Rep. Hand. A couple of things. Level dollar. I mean, I wish the amendment actually put the level dollar in actual statute, because it's a substantial interest and cost savings by paying off debt faster. So that's kind of the fundamental difference. I don't know of any other method other than level percent of pay, but level or level dollar. So I'm not an expert. So I guess if this amendment is adopted, they could probably use a different methodology. I'm not aware of any, but maybe there is. So the one question I did have is the may and the shall, page 8, line 10. To me, this only applies to the increase in the employer contribution and not the reduction in PERPA, at least unless I'm misreading the amendment through the chair.
Representative Hannon.
Mr. Chairman, could I have a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:18 p.m. Representative Hannon.
Mr. Co-Chair, I don't think it applies to PERPA from my quick read, but I will defer to the sponsor, has more flexible knowledge in reading this than I do, where each section stacked on each other.
Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Chair. It does appear that it only applies to member contributions. This is the giant lever, if you will, where PERPA is certainly the lesser, but it is certainly within the spirit of both the amendment and the bill to include both those items. And somebody may make a conceptual amendment that Ledge Legal could clean up for us.
Representative Stapp.
I am a big fan of conceptual amendments, but I will say, Mr. Chair, this bill is, I'm a little scared to make a conceptual amendment on this bill because it's so technical. So, okay. So I think maybe somewhere down the line, if this amendment gets adopted, maybe somebody fixes that in the proper way. Like I said, it's a closed-door decision, right, because it's a constitutional requirement, and I would hate to screw it up on a conceptual amendment. So,
Representative Cobb?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Staff. I appreciate that.
Representative Hammond?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And I will just say, so it's on the record, it was not my intent to leave that out, but I was looking for the may to shall, and that, so I would not at all be opposed to an amendment that covers PURPA.
Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I was just going to simply say that, you know, with this being shared risk means that when one takes an action, they all take an action, and so I would definitely support that change being across the board for all being a shall.
Okay. Further questions or comments on amendment number two? Seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection. Representative Stepp, do you remove your objection?
Yeah, I will remove my objection, Mr. Chair, though at some point it would be nice to know why we couldn't just put level dollar in statute, but I'll remove my objection at the moment.
So. Okay. We have an objection. Representative Ballard?
Object.
Okay. Would you like to speak to your objection?
No.
Okay. Representative Hannah, do you have another comment?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and I will speak to just the level dollar. And what was described to me is that depending on, right now in statute, we are explicit about which value. So even if our actuarials had said to our ARM board, this isn't the best way, we should be using level dollar, they didn't have that flexibility in the economic circumstances that would recommend it to do that. So taking out the specificity, I don't want to replace it with an additional specificity in thinking this could be the policy and law for the next 20 years, and we want the ARM board, based on good, sound actuarial evidence, to make sure that we're doing it fairly quickly to address the concerns. And since things like the size of your payroll changes, but if it doesn't rebound or if you have a recession, their level dollar level might be more appropriate, but not always. So I prefer not to have a specificity when that was the recommendation from the ARM board and actuarials to be able to have that flexibility.
Okay. Okay, so we have an objection that's been maintained. And if there are no further comments, Madam Clerk, on amendment number two, if you could please call the roll.
Representative Galvin.
Yes.
Representative Allard.
No.
Representative Stapp.
Pass.
Representative Johnson.
Pass.
Representative Bynum.
Pass.
Representative Jimmy.
Yes.
Representative Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes.
Representative Stapp.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Bynum.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Schrage.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Nine yay, two nay.
On a vote of nine yay, two nay.
I'd like to reconsider.
Oh, actually, well, if we could void the roll, and we'll, if you could recall the vote.
Representative Bynum.
Yes.
Representative Allard.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Jimmy.
Yes.
Representative Stapp.
Yes.
Representative Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes.
Representative Galvin.
Yes.
Representative Schrage.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
10 yay, 1 nay.
And so on a vote of 10 yay to 1 nay, amendment number 2 to House Bill 78 has been adopted. So with that, we're going to jump right into amendment number 3, and that's Co-Chair Representative Schrage.
I move amendment number 3.
Okay. Object. And Representative Schrage.
Okay, so amendment number 3 changes retirees' health care eligibility based on the recommendations provided by the Alaska Retirement Management Board during their March meeting.
The Arm Board passed two resolutions in support of reforming access to retiree health care benefits without increasing benefits liabilities. The first change removes the statutory requirement that members be employed within the 12 months preceding retirement. Current law requires members to be actively employed in the final 12 months before retirement, even if they met the age and service benchmarks, forcing them to either delay retirement or seek temporary reemployment to meet the eligibility requirement. The second change in this amendment is to reduce the service threshold from 25 to 20 years for PER public safety employees per public safety employees, and from 30 to 25 for non-public safety PERS and CHERS employees. This change is aligned with national norms, makes retirement health care eligibility more attainable, and may reduce turnover. As stated earlier, both changes were recommended by the Arm Board in their published resolutions from their March meeting. Additionally, the DC retiree health care plan will remain overfunded even with these changes. I urge support for the amendment.
Okay, thank you. Question, or Representative Cobb, do you have any thoughts?
Chair Foster, I appreciate the amendment by Representative Schrage. This is strongly supported by the Arm Board. One of the things they're looking at is the overfundedness of our health trust, the frustration that they can't combine the valuations. The health trust has two things that they considered were the first change that Representative Schrage covered, they considered to be completely hostile to employees getting health care benefits. Both these only pertain to health care, and that is if you've met your age in service, you worked 10 years, which is the minimum number of years you have to work in PERS or CHERS to become eligible for your health care. You are able to get your health savings account, but to get your health care, your state of Alaska health care to supplement your Medicare when you turn 65, you have to come back to work when you're 64. No matter what you've done in your life, you better come back to Alaska. You're 64, work 12 months. You have to retire directly out of the plan into Medicare, which 15 years ago when we did this really wasn't well thought through. The record shows that there really wasn't a clear understanding of what that would mean. But now we have all these employees who are approaching this, and they're realizing wherever they're at in the United States or in Alaska, they better find an employer when they're 64 who will give them a job so they can work 12 months when they've already met their time and service requirements to be eligible. But we added one more hurdle to get your Alaska Care supplemental card. How we already address that in statute is by years of service is what you pay for your Alaska Care supplement. So if you have 10 to 14 years, you have to pay 30% of the premium. So the state statute already addresses your contribution based on your years of service. The additional requirement that you come back and work your 64th year of life and retire at 65 into Medicare to get your Alaska Care employee card, just like we have, they said is just not good. And so their recommendation strongly was to remove that hurdle. This does that. And then secondly, again, just for employees in PERS and TERS, it reduces by 5 years the numbers of years you have to work to have obtained your Alaska Care card health plan in addition to your health savings account. And the Arm Board actuary, they've run the numbers, and our health trust fund is still going to be significantly overfunded even with these amendments. So appreciate the amendment, Co-Chair Schrage, and we think it's a good thing to do for our workforce.
Thanks, Representative Bynum.
Oh, I'm in two places at once. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. My question for this is, I really like the first part of this. The second part of this, I'm not exactly sure about. It sounds like what we're doing is that we're changing the law for the existing PERS and TERS employees that actually get the health care. But the bill in front of us is for the new plan, which doesn't include that health care. We have an old health care system that's overfunded. All those employees that are currently retired are enjoying that health care opportunity. All the employees that are going to be retiring are enjoying that health care and opportunity. And not only are we saying that, we're saying that not only that, you can do it 5 years sooner. But if you're in PERS 4 or if you're going into this new plan, no luck for you. So I don't know that I particularly care for how we're approaching the healthcare component of this thing across the board. Like I said, I do like and appreciate the first portion of this. That makes a lot of sense to me, why we'd be changing the plan for previous agreed-upon retirement system without taking consideration for what this bill is actually supposed to do, which is reform health pension plans for future employees, is beyond me. Thank you.
Further, Representative Cobb?
Yes, just in response. Representative, through the chair, Representative Bynum, so this plan adopts in whole the current health care plan that we have. It makes no change to it. So this change would, yes, it would benefit people coming into the plan, but current defined contribution plans, employees would also benefit from it. The change is would be shared by any employee in the defined contribution plan. The ARM board has recognized this because now we have people 15, 16, 17 years in and coming up on that eligibility date to get their health care, and they've realized with the health trust being so overfunded by, they're not changing the time and service to get your pension, mind you. This is time and service just to get your health care. So by reducing TERS and PERS from 30 to 25 years and public safety from 25 to 20, it allows employees to, you're not stuck in a cycle of just working for the health care, but you've earned that at that point, and it would apply to the entire Tier 4 health plan because that is what we are adopting into the new plan. There's no legacy DB tier health benefits in the new plan or in Tier 4 that we're in now. So the amendment would apply to everybody and going forward.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I Co-Chair Foster, I appreciate the comments from Representative Bynum. I do understand that it is sort of two separate issues on this amendment, but I want to thank Representative Shragi, because to me, this is going to please a lot of Alaskans who currently are upset that our health, we have this fund that we can't do anything with, and we know it has to be associated with health care. And now we're able to give more Alaskans more access to health care. And I think that is an opportunity that this bill is now taking advantage of in ways that I didn't expect. And I have to say that I'm grateful for it because especially since we know that the funds are there and it can't be used for the newcomers who come in. There's no way we can write a law that would allow that, unfortunately. But because it does give more to those who have been public servant workers for so long, more health care access, I support it. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions or comments? Representative Stout.
Yeah, a couple of things here, Mr. Co-Chair. Thanks for the opportunity. So basically two of these sections are added into the bill. So that means you wouldn't be able to make these changes recommended by the ARM board unless the bill passed the final process and signed into law. So I'm curious whether or not, one, you'd like to run that as a separate bill so we can take a hard look at it. I'm not necessarily opposed to the changes. They make sense to me. I do have one question. If someone could explain to me this section that's being deleted, the member has been an active member for at least 12 months before application for retirement. So what is that actual process look like? Is that you leave your place of employment and then you can't have your health benefits for 12 months before you can apply, or is that something different through the chair?
Representative Cobb?
Yeah, this language that we're removing, as Representative Stapp is highlighting, is very explicitly requiring you that when you retire, it must be directly from the plan to get your health care benefit. You had to have worked the previous 12 months as an employee. So that is the debacle wherein someone could have been a state employee from 22 to 32 years of age, did their minimum 10 years, got off and served America, who knows whatever they did, but now they're coming back when they're 64 because it requires them to retire directly from the plan into Medicare eligibility, which is an impossibly high hurdle and one that will screen out many otherwise eligible employees from having any supplemental to Medicare at all.
Okay. Representative Stapp.
I mean, yeah. So what happens to the money, I guess, if they don't get it? So if you have to retire directly out of the plan, you have an HRA, would you just not have access to HRA money through the chair? Or?
So, yes, thank you, Representative Stapp. So right now, if you have your 10 years of service, you would have your health savings account, a little bit of money that it is, but you just wouldn't be eligible for your health savings supplemental to Medicare. So right now, the health care employee card that you all have in your wallets from being state employees, you wouldn't have that as you go into Medicare. You would only be on Medicare with no support or secondary from the state at all.
Okay. So I think I get it now. So basically we have a Medicare supplement product that we offer retirees if as long as they retire out of the plan and into Medicare, at age 64. Okay, that makes sense. I would say that probably not opposed to the concept here. I would like to see it in a different bill, though, so that's probably why I'll oppose the amendment, although, like, I'm not. I think it's probably fine. Let's put it that way. I'm just a little wary of putting it in the bill.
Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. If our folks are online for the actuarial portion, it'd be really nice to know. I know that the health care portion is currently overfunded or funded, I think, 150% or so. We know that the actual pension fund is well underfunded, and there's also, obviously a past debt liability that we're currently trying to pay that thing down and pay it off. My only concern would be is if all of a sudden we're going to say that all the people that are under current plan, PERS 1, 2, 3, and TERS 1 and 2, if they're able to all of a sudden retire earlier and collect their full medical benefit here, does that impact the potential future where that fund, although being overfunded today, with people living longer and having those resources available, could it potentially impact that fund where it would become underfunded and then would cost cause an unfunded liability? Thank you.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Bynum. So this amendment only applies to Tier 4. Doesn't apply to Tier 3, Tier 2, Tier 1 DB. None of those employees this would apply to. It only applies to the people in the health can of our current defined contribution. Thank you.
Briefities.
House Finance back on record at 2:36 p.m. Any further questions on amendment number 3? Seeing no further questions, I believe Representative Johnson, did you have the objection?
No.
Okay.
Maybe I did. Yeah, I'll leave. Okay. Left my jurisdiction.
Okay, the objection has been removed. Any further objections? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, amendment number 3 to House Bill 78 has been adopted. Representative Stapp, do you have a
comment?
Oh.
I was reading. Sorry. I think it's going to pass, though, but I think I'm still going to maintain my objection.
Okay.
I don't know if I can get a do-over. If not, I won't be too sad.
Yeah, it's official action, I guess. I mean, we could do a rescinding motion or something.
You kept reading.
Okay. Okay, we've got amendment number 4, Representative Co-Chair Josephson.
I will not be offering amendment number 4.
Okay. Amendment number 5, Representative Stapp.
All right. I move amendment number 5.
Object for the purpose of the discussion, Representative Stapp.
Okay. So as everyone knows, this is a pretty complicated bill. Like I said, unlike almost anything else we do here in this committee, most of the changes of this will be able to become law. We would not be able to unwind for people. So that's why it's kind of a big bill. I know we've had 9 hearings on this bill, Mr. Co-Chair, but I would have liked 19 probably because of the complexity. So I'm going to go through amendment number 5 here because it does a lot of different things. I did provide a sectional made by my staff who is available to explain things if people have questions. But basically, several things this amendment looks to do. Number one, in page one, line one, section of the amendment, we basically look to have Tier 4 DC plan be left open to all participants and make that the default for all new hires and existing hires. So there was an amendment earlier that was adopted that made the DB the default and left the DC open. What my amendment elects to do is basically the opposite of that, to leave the defined contribution open, allowing employees to elect, i.e. buy into the DB portion of Tier 5 for the first the way it's written in my amendment is until they vest into into the DC plan. So from the point of new employment to the point of vesting, they can opt into the DB plan so far as they pay the proper discount rate associated in the plan. So that's the first structural change. That's a pretty big structural change, Mr. Co-Chair. The second thing that my amendment is going to do is in effect to raise the maximum employee contribution rate from 12% to 14% of salary. So we talked this at length. Our actuarials really didn't indicate that they thought that the employee contributions to this bill would ever kind of rise to the level of 12%. The reason I have it in an amendment is because in the event that that were to happen, we would not be able to go back and raise that percentage on the existing employees later in the event the plan was unfunded. And that's Section 8, page 3, line 4 of my amendment. Continuing on, there are several clarifications about language changes that make that conforming. Then the third structural thing that I look to do in the amendment is to do what we had talked about earlier in Rep. Hannon's amendment with the may to shall with the ARM board. The only difference between what she did in effect and mine is mine does include the PERPA, not just the increase in an employee contribution, but it does include the PERPA from a may to a shall. The next thing that it does, I'm going to make sure I'm not out of order here, but it should specify for basically non-state employers, i.e. municipal employers who are participating in Tier 5, that they will be paying the full actuarial rate in terms of the employer contribution portion on a Tier 5. Concept there is to stop any unfunded liability from being assumed by the state. City of Anchorage employees, for example, they are not state employees. They are City of Anchorage employees. Therefore, if the City of Anchorage wants to participate in the benefit plan, in my opinion, they should be responsible for the entirety of the liability because they're their employees and they're not our employees. The next thing that my amendment looks to do is, and I apologize for the length and the breadth of it. It's a little tricky. Basically, it looks to attempt to change the ARM board's directive from raising contribution rates at the same time. I think if I had more time on this bill, I would probably craft that section a little bit more appropriately, but it is important to put on the record, and that is page 3, line 12 of the amendment removes language stating that the ARM board cannot increase the employer's contribution unless the employee's contribution were increased at an equal amount. Not entirely sure what to do with that provision. Mr. Co-Chair, the reason I put it in the amendment because I was trying to see what would be how you could make those percentages rise at equal percent because I don't really like the fact that the employer portion remains basically uncapped. I'm honestly not a big fan of how I worked that into my amendment, but like I said, it took Bledge Legal 6.5 days to draft this, so it was the best I could do with the time. And I think that's it. I'm going to look at my staff to make sure I didn't leave anything out. He says one more thing. Mr. Chair, could I call my staff up to explain
Mr.
this?
Mr. Bernard Aoto, if you could please put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bernard Aoto, staff to Representative Stapp. The representative got everything there except for on the amendment. It's the last item on page 4 of the handout. It references to page 7, line 12 of the amendment. It essentially just removes the repeal language since the defined contribution plan is remaining open. There's currently a provision in statute that allows current defined benefit employees, Tier 1, 2, and 3, to opt into the defined contribution plan. The bill currently repeals those statutes. This removes those statutes from being repealed.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Representative Kopp, any thoughts on amendment number 5?
Thank you, Chair Foster. I just want to say I appreciate the thought that Representative Stapp put into this. Based on his own uncertainties about drafting, I would not encourage the committee to adopt it. But I do want to address just in concept some of the very good points he brought up. So the first one, dealing with switching the default from defined benefit participants, as Representative Josephson introduced, to a defined contribution. If we adopted a plan where defined contribution was the default, we would be excluding a large group of future employees, and the amendment would shrink the participant base and limit new contributions that help sustain the plan over time. So we just heard Mr. Kirshner just a few minutes ago speaking to Representative Josephson's amendment, saying that there was not an actuarial risk with that approach. We know we're going to have maybe 20-25% of people opt into DC, and he said those people are just going to decrease the cost of the plan. But if you are having a default into a DC, intentionally growing that group, then you are actually losing your participant contributions into your DB plan. And if that's the policy of the bill and the policy of the state is to have a stronger retirement plan, this actually kind of goes against the very nature of what we're trying to do. We're not trying to weaken the financial foundation of the system. We're trying to offer a shared risk pension that is going to be strong and reliable for the future of our state and maintain, not maintain any of the failed elements of the previous defined contribution experiment. So I'm not excited about that. The raising the contribution of employees from 12 to 14%, historically in previous versions of this bill, it was 8 to 10%. Then Representative Bart Lebon had an amendment in this committee that raised it from 10 to 12. Yeah. And the actuaries have, no matter who they are, have all said that they really don't see those levers coming into play. Mr. Kirshner himself said he sees the plan as so structurally balanced that he did not see the unfunded liability occurring, as some might project, anywhere near even the 90% level that would cause these levers to come into play to begin with. So by increasing the possible future employee contribution all the way up to 14, it's unnecessary. And also increases would be, as actuaries like to use the term, based on basis points or just minute adjustments, they would be like the employer contributions would probably go from 8 to 8.1. They would be minute adjustments because they have such a significant fiscal impact when an adjustment is made. Secondly, I think that linking the employer-employee contribution is important because it underscores that the bill is a shared risk. In other words, we're all in this together, including the retirees who, as we know, stand to have their post-retirement pension adjustment, their inflation proofing of their dollars reduced if one of those levers comes into play. So based on the testimony we've had from the actuaries on the bill, the structural soundness, that they do not see additional unfunded liability to the state. Again, the unfunded liability of the defined benefit tiers is a whole other animal. This is a completely different plan that would do nothing to the old tiers liability. In this new plan going forward, they do not see it adding unfunded liability, so I think raising the amount of employee contributions is unnecessary.
Good, thank you. Questions, comments? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I appreciate the maker of the amendment. I support the amendment. I think there's a lot of good ideas in there. I would have just a slight rebuttal in the sense that If we say that there's no risk that this would ever, that the 14% would ever trigger, then there's no risk in putting it in to protect us into the future. So I think that that's an important part of it. I do also recognize that we did have a very short amount of time to actually try to work on workable amendments in such a complicated bill. And although I believe, and I'm not going to speak for the maker of the amendment, I think what his concern was is that he would like to be able to take the next 3 months to work on this, as opposed to what we've done here is the last week. So I have a lot of confidence in what was done with this work here, fully supported. I think it's a good amendment. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Representative Call.
I just one more additional point that Representative Stapp raised that I wanted to comment on. He spoke about the unfunded actuarial liability and that how the state currently has addressed that in the previous pension tiers as we capped the non-state employers' percent of payroll that they have to pay at 22%. And he was suggesting in this amendment that we remove that cap. Of course, the Alaska Municipal League has not been commented on this. I can only imagine how they would react to that. But I would remind the committee that with the actuary projecting no unfunded liability scenario in this new plan going forward, or nothing that would cause these levers to go into play, the actual cost of these plans without an unfunded actuarial liability, in other words, a perfectly funded plan, is going to be about 13% for PERS and about the same for TERS. So already well below the 22%. Now, if I would have a chance to talk this through with the Alaska Municipal League and get their common understanding on this, I think that would be a different scenario. But because local government, if you've ever been a mayor or a city manager, you can understand how they might react to not fully understanding this. And I would recommend that if something like this is adopted, that we would do it after we have a chance. So to talk to AML, I've tried to and do have a good communication with them, but I'm sure this is something they'd be very interested in.
Representative Bynum, did you have a follow-up on that?
I have brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:51 p.m. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I just wanted to ask the maker of the amendment, does the cap removal that we're talking about, the 22% cap, is that effective only for this new plan and the past debt liability would still stay in place? That's just making sure that this is only for the new plan.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, the Chair, Rep. Bynum. That's correct. So the way my amendment works is on Tier 5, if you were to go back to DB, right, we would basically save from now on the new plan that liability, that is an employer liability for your employees, i.e. if you're a municipal government and you are in PERS and you opt into that, going forward, like that employer portion of liability, that's something the state is never going to assume because unless this law were to be changed, of course, down the road. So it doesn't float the contributions for the existing unfunded liability. It just says on Tier 5, if you're a non-state employer, that's going to be your liability if there is a liability. And, you know, like the member from Anchorage whose bill it is, I mean, the actuarial has said there is not going to be any liability. So
thank you.
Okay. I don't see any further questions, comments. Representative Stapp, do you have a wrap-up?
Yeah, I just have a wrap-up, Mr. Co-Chair. Appreciate it. And like I said, I'm first person to tell you that I've spent a lot of time kind of thinking of the mechanism in this bill, and I think I have offered a lot of good ideas to try to improve it in terms of being more sound on risk. I will say that I do, on a personal level, like I mentioned earlier, I think there's a couple of things in this amendment that I wish I had more time to tweak, but I understand the kind of will of the committee. But I also remind the committee that I did ask Mr. Kircher, the actuarial, a very specific question. I asked him if he was wrong, would he pay us the liability, and he said no.
right? So the whole purpose about risk controls in a plan like this is because when we first started a defined benefit, I'm pretty sure nobody thought they'd have a big unfunded liability. Pretty sure nobody thought that in the 80s. Pretty sure nobody thought that in the 90s, and then it happened, right? So I hope for the best. I mean, look, in an ideal scenario, everything works out perfectly, and the employee contributions actually go down because the plan performs so well, and we never have to worry about anything. But just know that you can't change it if you adopt it, because that's based on the nature of our Constitution. So, and that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay, thank you. I'll maintain my objection. And so with that, Madam Clerk, if you could please call the roll.
Representative Allard.
Yes.
Representative Hannon.
No.
Representative Stapp.
Yes.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes.
Representative Bynum.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Jimmy.
No.
Representative Galvin.
No.
Representative Schrage.
No.
Representative Josephson.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
5 yea, 6 nay.
And so on a vote of 5 yea, 6 nay, amendment number 5 has not been adopted. That takes us to amendment number 6, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I move Amendment 6.
And we've got an objection. Representative Bynum.
Thank you. Just for to be clear, movement or the Amendment number 6, what it does is that for the purposes of this amendment, it ensures that there's greater fiscal discipline and realism in the fiscal assumptions used by the Alaska's retirement system. By anchoring the projected returns of the actual historical performance. So page 22, line 3, it adds the requirement that the ARM board must annually determine a projected annual rate of return on investments which cannot exceed the rolling average rate of return over the most recent 10 calendar years. The impact of this is that it prevents from an overly optimistic investment return assumption when calculating pension liabilities and funding requirements. Example of this is that if over the past 10 years investment return was 6.2%, the board cannot assume a higher rate, for example, 7.25% percent in its projections. Page 22, line 13. It ensures that the 10-year rolling average investment return rate is included alongside the actuarial assumption reviewed by the board. The impact is that this solidifies the role of the actual investment history in shaping long-term fiscal assumptions and keeps the future policy grounded in the reality of the markets. So why it matters? By tying projections to historical investment performance, this amendment aims to reduce the risk of underfunding the retirement obligation due to inflationary expectations of future investment earnings. This is particularly important in managing long-term solvency of the defined benefit pension plan. And so basically what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to prevent what we're currently experiencing in our previous plans, is that they become underfunded and we hold large debt liabilities. And I do understand that there is in this plan levers that are supposed to be working together to increase those costs when the plan itself is underfunded, but we would like to try to prevent to be in that condition to begin with. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Representative Kopp, thoughts?
Chair Foster, thank you for the amendment. Representative Bynum, so I oppose the amendment fairly strongly. This will be really viewed as hostile by local government. I'll explain why. Is the amendment arbitrarily caps the investment return assumption at the 10-year rolling average, regardless of market conditions, portfolio changes, or any professional actuarial guidance from the board. Alaska's actuaries and the ARM board actuaries already review the return assumptions annually using national standards and long-term forecasts, not just past performance. So if you lower the assumed rate of return, you could force the state to report higher liabilities, and you would increase employer contributions, including the state's contributions and local government employers' contributions, even if the actuaries didn't recommend that. I think this will lead to unnecessary pressure on local governments and agencies, especially during budget shortfalls. I think the amendment is well intended, but again, I think that the actuarial guidance between the ARM board's actuary, the state's actuary, and a third actuary, which throws those up, is better than us trying to be prescriptive and telling them how to go beyond the five-year rolling average that they already do for smoothing, going to a 10. I just see it as unnecessary and could have some real harmful effects to particularly local government. Thank you.
Do we have any comments or questions? Amendment number 6. We'll go to wrap up. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I wouldn't be offering the amendment if I had full confidence in what we've been doing. And obviously, we hold a multi-billion dollar deficit in our previous plans. I think this is one way to help prevent that from happening, although it doesn't completely fix it. If we're worried about what an actuarial is doing on projecting future returns, and we're going to bank our plan on that and our future obligations, I think I'm in the wrong business. I'd love to be able to have somebody tell me that they can predict what these future markets are doing and not use previous predictors on what they have been doing. I know that our current actuarials or the history of that has not been in the positive direction ever for us. It's always been in the wrong direction, hence why we have a multi-billion dollar deficit. I urge your support in trying to maintain the future of this pension plan without a debt liability potentially coming at us. And as one final comment, I would say the previous amendment we had did try to address what pressures would be on the municipal governments. We are taking on liability for employees that are not the state's employees. That's a fact with this plan. We're taking on liabilities for employees that are not the state's employees. The municipal governments, as much as I support municipal governments, have a responsibility to care for their employees. This is a looking forward plan, not a looking backwards plan, and I think that we should hold those municipal governments responsible for caring for their employees in a responsible way. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hannon, do you maintain your objection?
I do.
Okay, the objection has been maintained. Madam Clerk, if you could please call the roll on Amendment Number 6.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Jimmy.
No.
Representative Bynum.
Yes.
Representative Galvin.
No.
Representative Allard.
No.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes.
Representative Hannon.
No.
Representative Stapp.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
No.
Representative Strage.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
Three yay, eight nay.
So on a vote of three yays to eight nays, Amendment Number 6 has not been adopted, and that takes us to our final amendment. That's Amendment Number 7. Representative Stapp.
Thank you. I move Amendment 7.
Okay.
I'll object.
We have an objection, Representative Stapp.
All right. So I brought this amendment forward, Mr. Co-Chair, just to let everybody know that we spent this entire time talking about benefits for state employees, and we really didn't mention supplemental benefit system at all, what it is, what it does, why it's a good thing or why it should not be a good thing. So this amendment actually would delete the supplemental benefit system from the new Tier 5 employees altogether. I don't actually want to do that, Mr. Co-Chair. I just want everyone to know that we spent an entire session talking about employee benefits, and we really didn't bring up the biggest one that acts as our Social Security supplemental. So in this amendment, you actually see what the supplemental benefit system is, what it does, what the employer contribution is, how it is in it replaces Social Security. Just to clear up things for people who didn't know that, maybe on this record and in the public, who didn't know we actually had that benefit that runs adjacent to our current DC plan. And now that I've accomplished that, Mr. Co-Chair, I'm going to withdraw the amendment.
Okay. Amendment number 7 has been withdrawn. I don't believe there are any further amendments. And if that is the case, if it is the will of the committee, I would entertain a motion. Representative Jimmy.
I would just like to note that for this defined benefits, I'm just going to make a small brief comment. Our educators and public safety officials deserve a retirement that works for them.
When I was in school, I only had one teacher from my freshman to my senior year, and teachers were able to stay in the village for over 20-plus years till they retired. Some moved to the village and could even buy their own home. My daughter, she has gone through 8 teachers. She's seen them come and go. Our districts are spending too much money hiring teachers from the Philippines and elsewhere, and it's not like it was back then. In Alaska, our public safety office officials deserve a good retirement as well. It is difficult to recruit and retain village public safety officers today. This is a challenging job because you are arresting your own loved ones, going through tragedies, and they have no days off. Even when they are scheduled, they always get called in right back into work. Commissioner Cockrell and Director Holscher and their team have done a great job with building up the VPSO program. But VPSOs and VPOs, especially VPOs, will not benefit from this legislation due to the unique nature of the grant program. They are not state employees. There's no legislative fix in this bill here today. The disparity in retirement benefits reflects broader economic inequalities between urban and rural. I support the bill because I know my children, our children back in my district, will benefit and help them to have a kind, stable, a stability that all children deserve in their education. But it will not help retain for, and recruit VPSOs, people in public safety. Like in my village right now, where my daughter is, where there is no VPSOs. Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Jimmy. Representative Co-Chair Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. With those comments, I'd now like to move House Bill 78, Work Order 34-LS0493/N, out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes, and that House Finance Committee authorizes legislative legal to make any necessary technical and or conforming changes.
Jack.
Okay, we have an objection. Representative Staff.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Kutcher. So I really wish we'd spend more time on this bill. I kind of wish that we had actually compared other options for retirement systems. I know my colleague here has a bill to enhance the DC plan. We didn't even bring it up yet. I think that you probably could make some tweaks to this bill. Tried to do that, Amendment 5. I don't think I had all the right ideas just to put on the record. But I do think, I hope, wherever this bill goes, that someone is going to take a good look at what it would look like if you had the employees defaulted into the DC as opposed to the DB. I hope that someone would take a look at what it would look like for AML if they understood that they should probably be carrying the liability for a new DB plan. And I hope that someone looks at some of the other mechanisms in the bill too. I will say this bill does have a fiscal note for next fiscal year. I'm curious if anyone could tell me what that amount of money is, where they're going to get it before they vote on it. Thanks.
Thank you. For the Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I want to say I appreciate the bill sponsor for bringing this topic forward. I've been a strong proponent of saying that we need to have retirement reform in the state of Alaska. I think that's an absolute must. But I don't think that we need to rush into that conversation with just one idea. The member from Fairbanks just said that there's been a lot of other ideas that we could be talking about that have been excluded from the conversation as a whole. We've had 9 hearings on this bill. A lot of those hearings were generalized presentations about talking about the importance and necessity of having a change in our system. I fully understand that's why I'm a big supporter of having reform. The bill in front of us, though, I have some major concerns about what it's actually going to do to help employees when they go to retire. One of the biggest things I've said that has been a concern for me, and when I was employing people, the biggest concerns for employees was what are they going to do when they go to retire and deal with their health care benefits when they bridge between retirement and their Medicare. So this bill doesn't do that. This bill doesn't fix that problem at all. This bill is a shared risk bill, which helps alleviate some of the liabilities that we have potentially coming to us, but it doesn't fix them fully. I think that we need more time, and I wish we had more time to actually fix these problems here in finance, because this is the only place this bill has come to be talked about in the House. I've listed some of my concerns with members, and I was told we're going to move this bill forward, and if we really want to do some tweaks to it, we'll fix it in the Senate. And I am not in favor of moving a piece of legislation like this to just fix it in the Senate. We should be working on this bill here and now. If we're unable to get the fixes and the negotiation of what we need to do to have an effective bill that will survive the process and be effective for our employees, we should be doing that now here. If we can't do it in the next 2 weeks when session is over, we should be working together in the interim so that when we come back in January, we can move a bill that we know that we can get through the process that will be friendly to employees of the state. And don't mean to put the sponsor on spot, but when I have these concerns, I was told this is not an employee-friendly bill. Let's make it employee-friendly. Let's make it something we can afford, and let's make sure we don't have future liability. So I'm going to currently right now be a no for moving this out of committee because I believe we should still be doing much, much work in making this something that is beneficial to our, not only our state employees, but get more feedback from our municipal governments who will also be saddled with the responsibility of what this will do. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, I've got in line Representative Galvin and then Josephson. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Coach Foster. In the nine hearings that I've been here, plus the years of other work that I know has been leading up to this, I just want to say thank you. I'm grateful for all of the work, and I'm going to also call the committee's attention to the enormous amounts of letters we have from so many different Alaskans, groups of workers who are really the backbone of our community, what keeps us safe, what keeps us smart, what keeps us healthy and strong. These are the workers who I'm looking at this pile of letters. And to me, I know we have our challenges that is really basically recruitment retention. How are we going to keep our workers here? How are we going to make sure that we're somewhere on the map of being competitive? And I know we've been missing this piece of a strong retirement system. And I know this isn't perfect. I know there's a lot of, especially hearing from rural Alaska and what's going on with our VPOs, that's a whole nother issue that I look forward to tackling with you because that's a different system problem that we have to fix. But this fixes a lot. It's not perfect, and I know that there's been so many concerns about whether or not it's going to go under like the previous plans have done, and I believe that members from the other body and members of this body have worked so hard for years to get to where we are today. And I just have nothing but gratitude to offer, support, and I hope that my constituents also feel a sense of positive hope for the future because a lot of folks are very upset right now, distraught even, knowing that when they call 911, we are already, you know, in my community alone, we are so far under the number of responders who need to be there. And this gives a little something to them, a little something to hang on to that we are trying to be competitive so that we can meet the primary challenge that we have, that's recruitment and retention. And I want to thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Okay. Representative Josephson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is too historic to not make a few comments about it. The first is that soon after the demise of the Tier 2 and 3, TERS and PERS, and the entry into the all DC plans, there were legislators looking at further reform. So just based on memory, I know that former Representative Holmes had a bill, former Representative Millett had a bill, I had a bill, then Representative Kopp had a bill. I know that Senator Egan got a bill through later in his career. I got a defined benefit bill for first responders through. And so I understand that there can always be further study, but this has been front and center for a very long time, and certainly was in the 33rd legislature when the other body in particular was looking at this in great, great detail. But I'm very happy today about this bill. You know, I think that this bill, first of all, it aims with the support of experts and using models from other states to achieve a plan that will be solvent and will not likely fall underneath the 90% threshold. And even the state's actuaries seem to indicate a belief in that. When we look at issues like the cost of training, I'm remembering in my bill that the most expensive first responders to train were, I believe, airport police and fire, because guess what? They were police and fire. And some of them the government spent $200,000 training these folks. Mm-hmm. There was a question, what's the bill cost? We have a fiscal note that reflects in FY27 just over $40 million. And, you know, I noted in the last hearing that in just the SNAP penalty, food stamp penalty, the state has an outlay of $12 million on that item alone. And we also know that the costs associated with this are because of its great and positive effect in reducing vacancy rates and making our governments, plural, more effective. We have triggers in this bill that are helpful. There's no COLA. We reduced the PRPA for those that leave the state. We have the 8 to 12% adjustment that could even impact retirees. We also shouldn't saddle future generations with the mistakes made in the previous defined benefit tier. And there are those who say the mistakes could have been overcome with patience and continuing contributions from folks in my age demographic. We have some criticisms that the bill isn't employee-friendly enough. I think that this was just meant to be a model that isn't fully gold-plated. That's all. You know, and when there's criticism that, well, there's going to be a healthcare gap, yep, this is not perfect. But at the time, that seemed to be the expensive feature. I say at the time because now we exceed 130% on coverage for the healthcare component. I think this is going to be a boon to public service in the best sense. It's going to populate some of these jobs that we just can't fill, and as a consequence, government suffers. And it's not just government for government's sake; it's government for commerce's sake. It's to make our private sector function better. And I just feel very, very strongly and proud today about this bill, and I'm eager to support it on the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I'd like to thank the sponsor for bringing this bill and having the discussions. There's still a lot of questions that need to be addressed. You know, we have a lot of fiscal notes, a lot of unknown fiscal notes, and costs associated with that. Really, they don't know. We have actuarials that have made predictions for years, have come up short for years, but yet we're going to use those same type of actuarials to say this is going to be okay. What I believe this bill is going to do is it's going to create decades of unfunded liability for the state of Alaska and the people of Alaska. We've heard talks about vacancy rates, and, you know, Alaska is on par with the nation on vacancy rates. We're right in the middle. So we've, you know, used that as a way to push this bill forward, but it's really not true. We are on par with the nation in vacancy rates. We had some really good amendments, really thoughtful amendments, and I want to thank the members that brought some really good amendments today that could have made this bill more palatable, in my opinion. And I think they were rejected for the wrong reason. And so I will be voting against this bill. I appreciate the discussions that we've had over these last few weeks and months, but I think there's a lot more work to do on this bill. And we have to understand the gravity of what we are doing. This is a constitutional obligation for decades to come for the state of Alaska that we will not be able to change. And that's a problem. If you think we have money problems today with our budget, this bill is going to add untold, unfunded liabilities to our state that we can't afford. So I'm definite no on this. And, you know, if there's somehow in the future where we can look at this type of legislation and come to some sort of a real understanding on what it's going to do. Because right now, I really don't believe that we all understand exactly what this is going to do to the state and to our citizens of Alaska and to our state employees, to our municipal employees. And I think that all needs to be worked out before we pass any type of legislation like this. Thank you.
Further comments or questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I won't go into lengthy detail. I've been through a few of these bills over time. But I think we're going backwards. The state, through some actuarial problems, we have an unfunded liability. That's only a portion of it. It's probably less than after we put $3 billion back in, it really didn't make any difference. We still have a big unfunded liability. So when Alaska went to a defined contribution plan, we did that differently than most states. And maybe the defined contribution plan isn't exactly what it could be, but it could be, I think there's a lot of people that look in their 401ks right now and would say that they're doing better than if they had a defined benefit plan for certain. There's not one size fits all, but states are doing their best right now a lot of times to get out from under these defined benefit plans that are just, they're just weighing them down. And it's a heavy burden that in Alaska, a lot of times we're 20 years behind. People say we're 20 years behind. Well, we were actually ahead of folks, and now we're going right back to where states are trying to get out of what we're trying to put ourselves back into. So is this the worst defined benefit plan ever? No. I mean, there's a lot of work that's been done on it. It's certainly not a gold-plated defined benefit plan. But I think what we have with defined contributions is admirable, and I think there was a way to somehow work those two together to make it a little more palatable to me. I also think that the municipalities we're going to put a lot, if we got the potential of even putting more on municipalities. Municipalities are already not being able to pay. Some that aren't paying to the state. So we'll see where we go. I don't think this is a magic bullet for retention and recruitment. It's easy to say what might happen, but these are intangibles that you can't predict. Maybe there'll be some change, but I wouldn't really hold my breath on that. You can project in the future, and there's no way to argue about that. You can sit and say, well, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. Well, there's no way in. But 5, 10, 15 years from now, no one's going to be here to prove they're right or wrong. I mean, it's just those are the kind of arguments that are easy to have and hard to prove. So I'll be a no vote. I think we're just going the wrong direction. I think think that there probably is a better way to do it. I think the intent is good. I think I think it's going to cost us more money than we think in the long run. Quite a bit more money. I just think it's inevitable, and I just don't think the benefits are going to be as big as people hope that they would be. I think this is a very hopeful plan, very aspirational, but I don't necessarily think it's going to get us where we need to go. It'll be a no vote.
Okay. Any further comments or questions? Okay. Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be an enthusiastic yes, not because this is fabulous and great for workers, but because for 15 years I've heard from public school employees who want to stop the revolving door that a DC plan has led to. I know this plan isn't perfect. It certainly is not a golden retirement system, but if it slows the revolving door of public employees, especially in our classrooms, it's worth it. And when people say the cost to this is substantial, the cost that we have had by having a crumbling, functioning government at state and local levels for 15 years is a huge cost that isn't measured in this. So giving an incentive for people to stay longer than 5 years as public employees is something I have always said I will support. And so I will be a happy yes today, even though it's not a perfect bill. It doesn't give all the benefits that I'd like it to see. I would like to see much better medical, but a step forward to slow the revolving door is what I want to happen. Thank you.
Further comments or questions? Seeing none, is the objection to move House Bill 78? Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
The objection is maintained. Okay, so with that, Madam Clerk, if you could please call the roll on House Bill 78.
Representative Tomaszewski.
No.
Representative Stapp.
No.
Representative Bynum.
No.
Representative Galvin.
Yes.
Representative Jimmy.
Yes.
Representative Allard.
No.
Representative Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Shragi.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
6 yay, 5 nay.
And so on a vote of 6 yay to 5 nay, House Bill 78, which is 34-LS0493/N, moves out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And we'll give Ledge Legal the authority to make necessary and conforming changes to implement the amendments that were adopted. If folks can remember to sign the committee report. Also, we do have another bill today on the docket, and we do have 2 weeks left in session, so we'll probably be going long, maybe a little more often than we normally might with some of these bills. So what I'd like to do is maybe take a 5-minute break and then come back and jump right into Senate Bill 50. That's the board extensions bill. And also I'd like to give Representative Kopp any final words here.
Oh, I thank the committee for all the comments, and I appreciate everybody's thoughtful reflection, and very happy to see the recognition of the work that's gone into this to be a lean, mean bill that is going to move the needle forward for Alaska. I really appreciate the work of the committee. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And with that, we're going to take a 5-minute at ease. So House Finance at ease. Okay, I'm going to call House Finance back to order. The time is currently 3:45 p.m. We do have one more bill today, and that is Senate Bill 80. That's the board extension bill. And I'd like to invite up Senator Bjorkman's staff. I believe he's in another meeting right now, and that's Ms. Savea Bieber. If you could please come to the table, put yourself on the record. Also, just so folks know, we should have, let me double check here, should have a number of people online, should be Director Sylvan Robb with Division of Corporations, Aaron Bloomquist, Chair of Big Game Commercial Services Board, Director Kevin Richard, Alcohol Beverage Control Board, Marijuana Control Board, Bailey Stewart, and Nicole Wary, Administrative Operations Manager, Division of Senior and Disability Services. So with that, I think we're going to, what we intend to do is just get the introduction. We'll go to public testimony, and then from there, let's see here, do we have, I guess, just go to questions after that. So with that, Ms. Avea, sorry, Bieber.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Savea Bieber, staff to Senator Bjorkman. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 80 today. Senator Bjorkman would like to extend apologies for being unable to attend. Before I start, he's down chairing Labor and Commerce Committee right now. This bill extends the sunset date of four boards, the Board of Massage Therapy, Marijuana Control Board, Alaska Commission on Aging, and the Big Game Commercial Services Board. SB 80 is a cleanup bill from last year. Technical procedural fix, sorry. It backdates the board extensions back to June of 2024 and extends them again as amended in the bill. The Board of Massage Therapists is comprised of five members that examine applications and issue licenses, adopt and enforce regulations, and establish standards of professional competence. Marijuana Control Board is comprised of five members that control the cultivation, manufacture, and sale of marijuana in the state. And the Alaska Commission on Aging is comprised of 11 members who help seniors live dignified lives, providing recommendations to the Alaska Housing Finance Corp and making recommendations to the governor and the legislature. The Big Game Commercial Services Board is comprised of nine members who prepare and grade written and practical guiding examinations, issue guide licenses, adopt regulations, and assist Department of Public Safety and Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development in their big game investigations. All four 2023 board audits concluded that the boards operated in the public's interest by actively amending regulations, conducting meetings in an effective manner, and enhancing public safety. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And I'd like to ask if Chris Curtis, our legislative auditor, if she could please come up and add any comments. Thank you for joining us. If you could put yourself on the record.
Good evening. I'm Chris Curtis, your state legislative auditor. Division of Legislative Audit did conduct sunset audits of all four boards being extended by SB 80. I believe all the copies of the audits are in your meeting packets. So last year I went through those in detail. So today I just plan to go through and explain what our recommended extensions are and then read through the recommendations and, of course, be available for questions. I can certainly go into more detail if you want, but at this point I'm thinking just a high-level overview. Okay, the first audit report is the Marijuana Control Board. So for this board, we recommended a three-year extension. Now, that was in recognition that a report issued by the governor's advisory task force on recreational marijuana was expected to lead to significant changes to the board's duties, as well as the Alcohol Marijuana Control Office, which is AMCO's duties. And there was a new information system expected to be implemented that was going to significantly change the enforcement and licensing process. So a three-year extension would allow for a more timely review of those significant changes, as well as align this board's extension date with the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board's extension date and allow us to look at AMCO support to both boards in next audit cycle. We have three recommendations. The first begins on page 20. We recommend AMCO's director establish procedures to ensure the marijuana handler permit documentation was properly maintained. We recommend, secondly, that the board and AMCO director continue to implement the new license and enforcement database. And then lastly, we recommend the legislature consider requiring marijuana board regulation changes be approved by a majority of board members. So if there's any questions, I can answer those.
Yeah, question, Representative Staff.
Yeah, thank Co-Chair Foster. To Ms. Kirst, always a pleasure to see you here. Thanks for all the wonderful work you do. So a couple things on the marijuana industry that I know. I'm curious if they came at the audit. One of the things a lot of folks talk about where I live is the transporting of the money, right, from Fairbanks to Anchorage. I don't know if we saw any problems in that. Most of these folks don't like driving their cars with big piles of cash to deposit in Anchorage. And the second thing would be enforcement issues with illegal grow operations. Don't know if you have any comments on those things through the chair.
Through the chair. We did not look at transportation. We simply look at the board functioning, not necessarily regulations themselves or the industry. Mm-hmm. Your second question had to do with, can you restate that?
Yeah. I'll do a quick follow-up. So I don't, it's probably outside the board's purview, so I'm not sure it's covered in the audit through the chair to Ms. Curtis. But a lot of the folks in industry are, let's say, perturbed at the, let's say, lack of enforcement of state law toward illegal operations that exist outside state, you know, basically black market growing operations or even selling operations, mm-hmm. and that's part of the mm-hmm. problem and the rub they have mm-hmm. with the current industry. I'm just curious if that came up in your audit of the control board at all through the chair.
Ms. Curtis?
Through the chair. We did look at the enforcement. On page 13 of the audit, we just list all the complaints, investigations, notice of violations, advisory notices, just a snapshot of what happened during the audit period. I like to track that every audit cycle to see if there's a decrease or an increase in just enforcement activities. But I don't believe that would look at black market, because I believe that would maybe be a criminal type of police as opposed to the board.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Okay. Representative Geldman.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Your last comment that you made in your report was recommendation number 3, that the legislature should consider requiring regulation changes be approved by the majority of members. I'm reading a little bit more of the context, but if you would go over that for the record, I'd appreciate it. And I see that there are not that many members, so if you could help us with that.
Ms. Curtis?
Thank you, through the chair. On page 9 of the audit, I have a summary of all the meetings that happened and the various votes that occurred. So the board for regulation changes just requires a majority vote with a quorum present. So a 5-member board, that means 3 members. So on, I believe, June of 2021, the board passed an increase in the level of THC in edibles. With 3 members present, they had a nay vote by public safety, and the public health and rural members were absent. So, yes, that was legal. However, we question whether it was in the public's best interest, as there was a lack of input from the rural and the public health. We do note that license actions require a vote by the majority of members, while regulation changes require just a vote from the majority. So a license action would take a minimum of 3 votes. The regulation changes require a minimum of 2 votes with a quorum present of 3. So we just raise that for policymakers to be aware through our audit cycle. And we just raise that as something to think about.
Follow-up?
Given
that you do these audits for so many different boards, I'm sure there are quite a few boards that make regulations that are related to health, for example, and this might be one that did in this case. Do others have majority? I mean, how does this set in with your recommendation in context?
Through the chair, I don't know about other boards. We did not look across. We just noted within this board itself, the statutes or regs were set in place to ensure a higher level of participation and agreement for licensing actions than we saw for regulation changes. And when this was the only meeting that they passed regulation changes, was only 3 people. So something that we saw of concern, maybe not a concern, but something we wanted to raise for your consideration.
Thank you.
Okay. Please continue, Ms. Curtis.
All right. The next sunset audit is Board of Massage Therapists. So for this board, we recommend a six-year extension. We had four recommendations, and they begin on page 12. First, we recommend DCBPL's director develop procedures to ensure licenses are not approved based on outdated documentation. Second, we recommend DCCED's commissioner work with policymakers to improve the recruitment and retention of investigators. Rec 3 is similar to improve the recruitment and retention of licensing staff. And then lastly, we recommend the board and DCBPL director consider increasing licensing fees to cover the cost of regulating the profession.
Okay. I don't see any questions.
Going on to the next sunset audit, which is the Big Game Commercial Services Board, we recommend a six-year extension, and we have two recommendations. The first begins on page 13. Rec 1, we recommend DCBPL's director, and that's the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing, that the director improve oversight procedures to ensure required licensure documentation is obtained and reviewed. And then secondly, we recommend the board consider whether the two private landholder board seats continue to be necessary for effective regulation.
Okay. Do we have any questions on this one? Okay. Just want to look at number two again here. Can you maybe expand on the second one a little bit?
Certainly. So during this audit period, we found one private landholder board seat was vacant for 12 months and then had unexcused absences for another 7 months. The second board seat was vacant for 31 months. And as a result, the two private landholder board seats lacked participation in most of the board meetings. A similar finding was made in the 2018 sunset audit. Now, when we brought this up with the board, no one seemed to be concerned about having that particular perspective participate in the board meetings. So as this was a recurring finding, we brought it to the board's attention to consider. Now, in their response to the audit, they did not believe that those needed to be removed from the board. They believed the boards and commissions office of the governor should do a better job of recruiting for those vacant board seats.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any further questions, so moving on to the next audit.
The last last board for your consideration is the Alaska Commission on Aging. This, we recommend an eight-year extension, and we had one recommendation. We recommend the commission's chair ensure the annual analysis and evaluation report is complete and provided to the legislature and the governor.
Okay. Well, that's the last sunset review report. I don't see any questions. So with that, thank you very much, Ms. Curtis. Okay, so let's go over to public testimony. I'm going to go ahead and open up public testimony on SB 80. And that's the extending boards bill. If folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. And is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? So I don't see anyone online who is wanting to testify. Is there anyone? I didn't see anybody. Just want to double check. No? Okay. I don't think so. Well, if there's anybody online, it looks like everybody's here for questions. One person has a yes, but I think they're with the state here and probably available for questions. So if for some reason we do skip over anyone, again, folks can submit their email written testimony to house.finance@akleg.gov. So with that, I'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 80. And so that takes us now over to the fiscal notes. And it looks like we have three, I believe, fiscal notes. Let's see here. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. And this is the question of three fiscal notes versus four. Is there no fiscal note for the Big Game Commercial Services Board?
I'm going to call up my staff, Mr. Brody Anderson.
For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Through the chair, Representative, we will double-check on that fourth fiscal note, but I believe that is what was submitted, are the three fiscal notes. Right. Okay. Thank you. Through the chair, I will start with fiscal note, and this will answer the representative's question as well. The fiscal note for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development from Corporations Business License Professional Licensing, OMB Component 2360, Control Code PJPGQ. If you'll turn to the second page of that fiscal note, this fiscal note traps both the Board of Massage Therapists and the Big Game Commercial Services Board into this one fiscal note. So, but we will double check as well, but this one does refer to both of those boards. The fiscal note in front of the committee reflects both a travel expenditure for $48,500, and that is for the five members of the Board of Massage Therapists and one staff, roughly $20,300 for the Board of Massage Therapists, and then $28,200 for the nine members of the Big Game Commercial Services Board and two staff members to attend those meetings. The other item is also $4,500 for services, which include items such as public notification for advertising, training and conference fees, and also stipends for the board members while they're attending the board meetings, for a total of $53,000. And if the committee would recognize that this is in the included in the governor's FY26 request column, not in the appropriation that they are requested, because these bills were previously passed in last year's. They were included in the fiscal note package for the operating budget, thus carry forwarded into this year's FY26 budget. So that is why they appear in those columns. All three of these fiscal notes will have that same funding in the governor's request because of the nature of the way they were funded last year.
And before we jump into the other two fiscal notes, Representative Ellard.
Thank you. I'm just kind of curious. I mean, we're in a really bad fiscal crunch. Is there a reason we can't be Zooming or Teamsing? I mean, why are we paying for all these people to travel? Is it that difficult? And who am I supposed to ask that question to?
So on this one, it looks like Ms. Sylvan Robb prepared the fiscal note. So Ms. Robb, if you could put yourself on the record and answer the question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Representative Allard, an important thing to note on our fiscal notes, Representative, is that all of our funding comes from designated general funds. It's all receipt funded services that comes from licensing fees paid. The reason the Big Game Commercial Services Board cannot meet by Zoom is that they also administer examinations in concurrence with those board meetings, and that requires board members to be there to attend in person.
Ms. Robb, sorry, it's a little hard to hear you. It's kind of sounding a little muffled. We couldn't quite hear you. You said there's a reason why they needed to meet in person. Ms. Robb?
I apologize, Mr. Chair. Now I'm having trouble hearing you. Could you repeat what you said?
Like it might be both ways. it was a little hard to hear your answer. Can you maybe try again?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Representative Allard, the reason the meetings are not held by Zoom, the Big Game Commercial Services Board conducts examinations in conjunction with their board meetings, and that requires the attendance of board members to assist with administering those exams. And the other thing that I wanted to point out, Mr. Chair, was that all of the funds being discussed for corporations, business, and professional licensing, so for the Board of Massage Therapy and the Big Game Commercial Services Board, these are receipts of supported services. So these come from licensing fees. This is DGF, not UGF.
And I think just to clarify on that last point, I think she was saying that these are DGF funds that come from, they're not UGF, and they come from licensing, I believe. Is that correct? Okay. Representative Ellard?
Yeah, thank you for the clarification.
Okay. And so with that, Mr. Anderson?
Moving on, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Appropriation, Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office with the same allocation, OMB component number 3119, control code FXDJJ. This fiscal note also once again appears as a governor's request in FY26. Starting in personal services, there is $1,273,000 in personal services. This is for 10 full-time positions, which includes one special investigator, three special investigators level one, three licensing examiner twos, one program coordinator level two, one licensing examiner number three, and one local government specialist. In travel, the total is $92,500. This is broken down into the following: $62,500 for five board members and two staff to attend five board meetings per year. Then there's an additional $15,000 for the enforcement travel to conduct the inspections, the audits, and investigations. And then an additional $15,000 of travel for the director and staff to attend conferences or training. In the services line, the total is $709,400. This is for this is the reimbursable service agreements for those core services that AMCO is required. Under the commodities line, you have a total of $62,900. This is broken up into $17,900 for printed material, $25,000 for enforcement supplies and ammunition, and $20,000 for office supplies. And then finally, under capital outlay, there is $12,500, and this is for a vehicle cost. Mr. Chairman, this also includes $19,100 of unrestricted general fund, and then the $2,131,200 of DGF or designated general funds for a total of $2,150,300. And all of this comes from either the licensing fees collected, which is required by the state, by the statutes and regulation, and or that small injection of UGF money. Mr. Chairman, that summarizes OMB component 3119.
And 2674.
The next one is the Department of Health, Senior Disability and Services, Allocation Commission on Aging, OMB component 2674, control code RDIPL. Before the committee, you have a personal service of $336,000 of personal services. That is for two full-time positions that work for the Alaska Commission on Aging. They have $70,500 in travel. They have $48,200 of services and $8,000 in commodities for a total of $462,700. That is broken up into interagency receipts of $261,300 and then $201,400 of mental health trust receipt authority. And there are two full-time positions there, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Any questions, Representative Ballard?
Thank you. And just, I'm learning a little bit here. So we're not using any general funds, right?
Mr. Anderson?
Through the chair, Representative, for the Commission on Aging, there are no UGF.
There are none?
There are none.
And Mr. Anderson, thank you, Co-Chair. There weren't any on the other fiscal notes either, were there?
Through the,
did I miss it?
Through the chair. Thank you. Through the chair, representative on OMB component 3119 for the Alcohol Marijuana Control Office. There is a small portion of $19,100 of UGF.
Sam Ballard.
Good question, Mr. Anderson. Maybe you can answer it. I mean, there might be someone on the phone too, but I mean, these are licenses, and why aren't we charging enough that that's not, and nothing is coming from the UGA, the general fund?
Mr. Anderson.
Through the chair, that's a great question. I believe the executive director or the chair.
I thought so too.
He is for the AMCO board. I don't have a good answer for that one, and
okay.
I believe he might be able to answer.
Okay. Mr. Kevin Richard, Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, is in Anchorage. Mr. Richard, if you could put yourself on the record.
Through the chair, this is Kevin Richard, Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. I would have to get back to you with a written response to what that that general fund dollar amount is, but I can have that to you quickly.
Okay. Can I just ask him a question?
Sure, Representative Ballard.
And I appreciate that. It's just that we're charging and we're doing all these licensing and all this kind of stuff. I would think that nothing would ever come out of the general fund. I do appreciate it if you could get back to me. Thank you very much.
Okay. Do we have any questions for the sponsor or regarding any of the fiscal notes? I don't see any questions. Okay. So, again, just to kind of recap, this is one of the bills that was didn't made it through, but was actually, no, it made it fully through. We need to, oh, it wasn't after. Because we have the single subject bills, and then we also have the after midnight. This was one of the after midnight also?
Or this is the single subject.
The single subject.
Single, okay.
Okay. So, so we've heard this before. We've just gotten the introduction. We've heard from our legislative auditor. We've gotten public testimony. We've addressed the fiscal notes. So the next step would be either set an amendment deadline or if folks who are wanting to move, I'm fine either way. Representative Hannon and then Representative Allard. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I would like to see us move this bill very soon. You might note that in one of the fiscal notes, it's only FY 26 and 27 because that's the audit level extension that was recommended. If we don't get it across the finish line this year, we have two boards that have to go into a statutory shutdown experience. They have a wind down of 1 year that because it got vetoed from last year from being multiple, they didn't begin their wind down, but they will have to if we don't get this bill through. They have to, by statute, wind down, shut down. There is $19,100 in the Marijuana Control Board fiscal note and UGF, but it's going to cost us $20,000 to wind them down and then recreate them next year if we don't get this bill across. And it's really close. I'm not saying that we have to move it today, but I would really like to see us move it this week so that it has a chance of getting across. If we amend it, we're either digging into, you know, because right now the bill reflects what it was last year with the extensions of the boards, the times relevant to the audits that were done, some of them 4 years ago, and would need to go into another audit cycle traditionally. So,
Representative Ballard, do you have a comment?
I do. I mean, I don't have a problem with it necessarily moving out. My still concern is if these are self-funding boards, and how do I put this? I'm going to be polite for the sake of Representative Josephson. if we are coming in front of this committee and I find that there's a UGF for the $19,000, I'm trying to figure out why are they in front of us and can't explain to me if I was on this, why you can't just explain to me why is there $19,000 coming out of the UGF when every ounce of their money should be coming out of the DGF?
And I think I'm
desperately looking for an answer, and then I probably could just say, yeah, let's go for it. But
well, and one thing I was going to potentially propose. We do have a missing member, and we could take it up either tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon, and we'll have that answer, and we'll have our full complement here. So that's something that we could do.
Okay.
I think Ms. Chris Curtis, would you like to come up and make a comment?
Thank you. For the record, this is Chris Curtis, State Legislative Auditor. So on page 17 of the Marijuana Control Board audit, we talk about that the marijuana fees are actually set at a level that exceeded the cost of regulation. And that is because when it was authorized, they were legislative intent language said they wanted to set the fees at a level that covered the cost of establishing $5.5 million. So they have been pumping actually money into the general fund to help repay that. And at the end of the audit, they still owed $868,000, and the management expected that to be paid by the end of FY24. So I can only tell you this was done in 2023, and consistently every year since it had been established, fees were set at a level higher than the cost of regulating. I just thought that might be relevant.
Great, thank you. Okay, do we have any further questions or comments? Representative Tomaszewski?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Just going back to the bill real quick, Section 1, Section 2, the dates. You may have spoke about why it goes from why we're changing it to 2024, and then in the next section, changing it back to 2032.
Ms. Bieber?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. So last year when we passed Senate Bill 189, we extended those dates, and the bill actually didn't get vetoed. It's under litigation right now, though. So it's still technically a law right now, and we're trying to fix it. So we're backdating what's in statute right now and then bringing it forward again so that we can clean the slate. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Thank you. It does, because I'm just looking at 2024 and they're already there. So, like you said.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, further questions or comments? Okay, Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I was just going to add my voice in support of bringing this up tomorrow after we have an opportunity to get any outstanding questions answered and have our one missing member back at the committee table. Thank you.
Perfect. Okay. Okay. Well, we'll either add it on to the morning or the afternoon meeting. I'll let my staff figure that out. We'll let folks know. We'll put a notice out. And let's see here. Okay. So with that, let's see here. Well, I was going to set an amendment deadline, but if it sounds like folks are probably not going to have amendments, if folks do, let us know and we'll coordinate that. But at this point, our next scheduled meeting is tomorrow morning, May 8th at 10 a.m., and at that meeting we'll hear potentially this bill SB 80, and if we do, it'll be the first one up, and then we'll go to HB 73, Complex Care Residential Homes. We'll take public testimony on that bill. Then we're going to go to HB 28, that's Teachers, State, Employees, Student Loan Program. We'll take public testimony on that. So if there's nothing else to come for the committee today, thank you very much. The time is 4:18, and we're adjourned.